So we are today in the 81st Psalm, Psalm 81. This is a psalm which is about the holidays. Now, not our holidays, but it is about the holiday season within the Jewish calendar, at least part of it. This is a really intense period in our schedule, isn't it? I mean, starting from around, Halloween, with all the things associated with that, and then a little less than a month later, you have Thanksgiving, and then a month later, you have Christmas, and then a week later, you have New Year's, and then it slows down for a while. This is our holiday season. Well, Israel had holidays throughout the year, but there was one intense period, and this psalm alludes to it. So, with that said, let's read Psalm 81, and then we'll get into our handout. For the choir director, on the Gittith, a psalm of Asaph. Sing for joy to God our strength. Shout joyfully to the God of Jacob. Raise a song, strike the timbrel, the sweet-sounding lyre with the harp. Blow the trumpet at the new moon, at the full moon, on our feast day. For it is a statute for Israel, an ordinance of the God of Jacob. He established it for a testimony in Joseph when he went throughout the land of Egypt. I heard a language that I did not know. I relieved his shoulder of the burden. His hands were freed from the basket. You called in trouble, and I rescued you. I answered you in the hiding place of thunder. I proved you at the waters of Meribah, Selah. Hear, O my people, and I will admonish you. O Israel, if you would listen to me, let there be no strange god among you. Nor shall you worship any foreign god. I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it. But my people did not listen to my voice, and Israel did not obey me. So I gave them over to the stubbornness of their heart to walk in their own devices. Oh, that my people would listen to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. I would quickly subdue their enemies and turn my hand against their adversaries. Those who hate the Lord would pretend obedience to him, and their time of punishment would be forever. But I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you. God add blessing to the reading of his word. Well, let's come to our handout and we'll talk about what kind of unusual psalm this is. It is an unusual psalm. If you think about the major kinds of psalms that there are, we think of psalms of lament and psalms of praise, psalms of thanks, and there's elements of praise in this, but there's something quite different, isn't there, where for most of the psalm, God himself is speaking. So one way we could label this, you see it at number one in your handout, is that this psalm is a prophetic summons to festival worship and obedience. That is, the psalmist is acting like a prophet, calling the nation and actually giving to them the words of God. Now, it opens up like a hymn of praise. The first five verses sound like this is going to be a praise psalm, where it's calling on everyone to sing to the Lord and praise him with instruments of different kinds, particularly verses 1 to 2. There's four different kinds of musical expression that's discussed. And then verse 3 mentions some particular days of worship that were in the month of the High Holy Days and the Feast of Tabernacles, where it says there in verse 3, blow the trumpet at the new moon, at the full moon, on our feast day. And I'll unpack what that is in just a little bit. But the majority of the psalm sounds very different than that. The majority of the psalm sounds like what we call a prophetic oracle. Usually this word oracle refers to the words of a prophet who is speaking directly for God, that you're getting a quotation from God through the mouth of a prophet. So this is, in a sense, then the message of God himself for the people who are coming to the holidays, coming to the festivals. Most of verses 5 through 16, verses 6 through 16, most of those verses are in the first person, I, as God describes what he has done for Israel and what he expects of Israel, what he wants for Israel. Because the voice is God's own, this is not just a sermon that a worship leader is recounting. This is a very word from God. It is an oracle. So what's the setting for this psalm, and how is it used? That is, what are the events that came, that gave birth to this, that the Spirit led the Asaphite to write this? Well, we know that it is by Asaph, or as we've seen in some of these psalms from 73 to 83, that means an Asaphite, one of the descendants of Asaph. Psalms 73 to 83 are all written or ascribed to Asaph, one of the chief musicians in David's day. And then his descendants were very active in composing music as well, even into the time close to the end of the Old Testament era in the days of Ezra. We don't know, though, if Psalm 81 is by Asaph himself, like some of them were, or by some of his descendants, because we can't date the psalm with any specificity. It could come from David's day. It could come from Hezekiah's day. There's just nothing specific to help us date it. The one bit of background that we know about is that this seems to describe, in part, the fall festivals of Israel. The fall festivals, particularly the ones that fall in the month of Tishri, which I'll mention in a moment. As I just mentioned, there aren't any other historical events to talk about. Like, it doesn't talk about the captivity. It doesn't talk about the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Philistines or anyone like that. But there is this mention of the holiday. So open up your handout. And I suppose there is one verse that could be understood as being about the captivity. In verse 12, it says, "I gave them over to the stubbornness of their heart to walk in their own devices." That's kind of a word of judgment. There was some kind of discipline on Israel. But it doesn't sound like this is the Assyrians taking away the tribes or the Babylonians overthrowing Jerusalem. It doesn't sound like Psalm 79 and Psalm 80, which are about the overthrows of the kingdoms of Israel. So because of that, I think that this psalm was probably written at before 722 B.C. 722, that's the year that the Assyrians take away the northern tribes. That's the beginning of the fall of the kingdoms of Israel. It seems to be that it's before that. One thing that is mentioned, though, verse 3 mentions some special moon holidays, moon-related holidays. Now, we don't think of our holidays being moon-related, but remember that Israel follows a lunar calendar. Their months are dictated by the setting of the full moon and the first moon. So, and there's a difference between the new moon and the full moon. Now, me being a solar calendar guy, I'm not too keen on this, but the new moon is actually when you can't see any moon. That's when the month on the lunar calendar starts. The moon is totally out. Whereas 15 days later is the full moon. So verse 3 mentions two phases of the month, the beginning of the month and the middle of the month. So there's actually more than one holiday that's being described. Every new moon, that falls on the first day of the month. And every first day of the month, every new moon was regarded as a special Sabbath. So whether it fell on a Wednesday or a Friday, that was like a Sabbath day. There was no work to be done, and some of the same Sabbath requirements occurred on that new moon. The seventh month of the year in the Hebrew calendar also had a full moon holiday on the 15th, and in between those two was the holiest of all the days in Israel's calendar. That seventh month, the name for the seventh month in Hebrew is the month Tishri, the month of Tishri. And that roughly falls between our September and October. This year, it happened to be entirely in September. So this year, in September, there was Rosh Hashanah, the first day with the new moon. And then 10 days later was Yom Kippur. And then 5 days later was the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles, which runs then for another 5 days. These are the high holy days in the Israelite calendar. So I think Psalm 70 or 81 might have been used originally to summon the people to come to the festivals. It's like, you know, we have holiday music. We're going to have a Christmas concert next week and another Christmas presentation the next week and another Christmas thing the week after that. And we're calling people to consider the great things that God has done in the sending of His Son. It seems like Psalm 81 was used to prepare people for these high holy days. And later on in Judaism, after the Old Testament was done and coming into the time of Christ, they actually scheduled Psalm 81 to be read publicly in the calendar. So today, even if you go to a traditional synagogue on the fifth day of Tishri, they will read Psalm 81. I've given you a chart there in the middle of the page about the autumn festivals, the fall festivals, which include what are called the High Holy Days. That's from the first day of Tishri up until the 10th day. That first day, which is a new moon, another name for that in the Old Testament is the Feast of Trumpets. And they were supposed to blow brass trumpets. Later on, as Judaism developed a second calendar, they called that Rosh Hashanah, head of the new year, head of the year. So there's actually two separate years that flow. There is a religious calendar in which Tishri is the seventh month, but in the government calendar, the civil calendar, Tishri is the first month. How's that for confusing? So there's actually two new years, depending on which calendar that you're looking at. So today, the Feast of Trumpets, that one day where trumpets are to be blasted to prepare people for the Day of Atonement, which is upcoming, that's also now called Rosh Hashanah. And then the next column, row, you see the 10th day, that's the Day of Atonement. The Hebrew name for that is Yom Kippur. And then the 15th day, which is the full moon, through the 23rd day, that is the Feast of Tabernacles, sometimes called the Feast of Booths. The Hebrew name for that is Sukkoth, which means booths, to commemorate how when the Israelites were in the wilderness, they were living in tents, but the Lord protected them and provided for them all those many years. And it's supposed to be a time of reflecting on how God provides for us, God cares for us, even when we don't have anything. So this seventh month seems to be what's in view here. There's also other references in the psalm to the Lord providing the things they need. Like, look at the end of verse 10. Open your mouth wide and I will fill it, which seems to be a reference to God providing them with the food that they need, which is appropriate to harvest festivals. And look again at verse 16. But I would feed you with the finest of wheat. Wheat is harvested in the fall. This is, again, fall-type food. Honey from the rock, you can get that, I guess, about any time of year. So all of these are indicators that Psalm 81 was intended to be used during this month of Tishri. Now, it's been placed here in the Psalms at Psalm 81. Remember that the Psalm numbers were not original. The Psalms were late in the time of the Old Testament, arranged in a certain order. It's been put here in the third book of the Psalms, Psalm 73 to 89, most of which are psalms written by other people other than David. So that's the part of the Psalms it's in. There's also something that connects this psalm with Psalms 77, 78, and 80, and that is that they all mention Joseph. They all mention Joseph. If you glance back at Psalm 77, verse 15, you have by your power redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. This is not the normal way of referring to Israel, but it can be done. Psalm 78, verse 67, also has a reference to Joseph. He also rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. In this spot, it's talking about the descendants of Joseph, who were the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and eventually God stopped making them the lead tribe and instead elected Judah to that. One more, Psalm 80, verse 1. Oh, give ear, shepherd of Israel, you who led Joseph like a flock. And then Psalm 80 is about the fall of the northern tribes. So here in Psalm 81, also a reference to Joseph, who was in Egypt. So that's one reason these psalms written at different times by different psalmists are put here together. Psalms 80 and 81 both talk about Israel coming out of Egypt. I'll not glance back at Psalm 80, verse 8, but you can see that connection. Another point of interest is Psalm 79 is a lament. It's about the fall of Jerusalem in the year 586. Psalm 80 is a lament about the fall of the northern tribes of Israel in 722 BC. And then Psalm 81 is almost like God's responding to the laments of Israel. Israel has been crying out to God over a long period of time, and Psalm 81 is put here to say God hears when his people cry. In fact, I think that's the point of the end of verse 5, where I think it's God speaking that he'd heard a voice that he'd not heard before. Now, that doesn't mean Psalm 81 was written in reply to these, but it's been placed here so that the reader, when the reader is going from lament to lament, finally you come to this psalm where there's some relief that is provided to the reader that God is still there and has desires his people to know him and know his blessing. Let me make some other notes about the, introduce the psalm over on the third page there. There is a divine speech we talked about. Psalm 81 is like a number of other psalms where there's a God speaking to the people. The two other psalms that are most like this are Psalms 50 and 95. You can flip forward to Psalm 95 and these words will sound familiar to you. They are quoted in the New Testament in the book of Hebrews. If you look at verse 7 of Psalm 95, we'll back up to verse 6. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. And then there in the middle of the verse, God begins to speak. Today, if you would hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the days of Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me. And so for the rest of the psalm, God speaks a prophetic word to the nation. Psalm 81 has a feel that is similar to that. Okay, back to Psalm 81 and the notes. There is something that makes reading Psalm 81 a little challenging is that there's a lot of pronoun switching. Pronouns like I, you, he, we, and so forth. Sometimes it's hard to know who's talking here. In verses 1 to 3, the psalmist is talking to Israel and giving them commands. You all sing for joy. You all shout for joy. Raise a song. So there's one person talking to a group. That goes verses 1 through 3. Verses 4 to 5, the psalmist talks about God in the third person. He did this. He commanded this. And then at the end of verse 5, there's a switch. Look at that at the end of verse 5. I heard a language that I did not know. And this is probably the most difficult verse in Psalm 81 to understand, and it's resulted in at least four different interpretations. So the question is, who is the speaker here in the end of verse 5? Who is the speaker? And I've listed out four views, and you'll see this sometimes in study Bibles, or even translations sometimes will render it in such a way to tip their hand one way or the other. Is it the psalmist talking, saying, hey, I heard suddenly God's voice, and let me tell you what God said? And then verse 6 would be the words of God. It's possible. It's possible. Psalm 95 has something like that, where the psalmist says, today, if you would hear his voice, and then he starts to quote God. Could be. Maybe it's Israel saying that now, for the first time in a long time, they've heard God's voice. Possible. I don't think that's as likely. Some have noticed that earlier in verse 5, there's a reference to Joseph being in Egypt. You know, he established it for a testimony in Joseph when he went out to the land of Egypt. Remember, when Joseph is in Egypt, he has to learn Egyptian. And when his brothers come to visit him in Egypt, they can't understand what the Egyptians are saying. And there's times where the story says there was no translator for them, so Joseph was able to say what he wanted to the people around him. Maybe, although if that's the point, it doesn't seem to connect with anything that follows. It just sort of, we're sort of left hanging there. I think the best way to understand it, number four, is that this is God hearing the cries of the people of Israel. And this would connect to something that is said in the book of Exodus, chapter 2. Why don't we turn back to that briefly? Exodus, chapter 2. No, yes, chapter 2, verse 23. I was looking at the wrong verse. Chapter 2, verse 23. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. I think what we have here in Psalm 81, verse 5, is a poetic restatement of that. God saying he heard something new, as it were, a new speech. Not a different language per se, but talk that he had not heard from the Israelites. And so then the verses that follow talk about what God did to get Israel out of Egypt. Verse 6, I relieved his shoulder of the burden. His hands were freed from the basket, talking about the end of the slavery of the Israelites. That verse 5 there is a difficult issue, but I think that what we just discussed makes the most sense of it. A few other things to note before we go through the visual outline chart is that Joseph is mentioned in this psalm, but in verse 5, when Joseph is mentioned, it doesn't seem like it's Joseph and the two sons he had and just those tribes. Psalm 78 talks about how God had used to have Ephraim, the son of Joseph, that he was in the lead position in the nation, but now he has been deselected and Judah was put up. But in this psalm, Joseph seems to represent all the nation of Israel, not just part of the nation. And if you think about it, from the perspective of the Egyptians, when the Egyptians looked at the Israelites, they viewed them as the family of Joseph. They didn't know Jacob. They didn't know Jacob slash Israel. The one they knew was Joseph. For all they knew, they were the Josephites. So I think that's why Joseph is mentioned here. When he went out to the land of Egypt, I think that's a reference to God going out against the Egyptians to bring the descendants of Joseph out of captivity. We see in this psalm how God remembers. God's remembrance is highlighted. Psalm 78 is a psalm of remembrance, how Israel needs to remember, but they don't remember. They keep forgetting what God did. This psalm shows us God does not forget. Look what I did for you. Look what the plans I had for you, and I still have those plans for you. Oh, that you would walk in my ways. God remembers. He recounts his delivering them from Egypt and then through the wilderness. There's also covenant reminders, about reminding them about that special covenant that they had with God made at Mount Sinai. And that's highlighted in verses 9 and 10. Look at verse 9. Let there be no strange god among you, nor shall you worship any foreign god. Which of the commandments does that remind you of? Number one, you shall have no other gods before me. And what comes right before verse number one? Well, the beginning of the Ten Commandments is, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the house of land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Well, look at verse 10. I am the Lord your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it's evoking the language of the Ten Commandments, the language of the covenant, that they would be faithful. God has been faithful to the covenant, and he calls them to be faithful to it as well. Verse 15, depending on what Bible version you're reading, could be translated a little differently. I think verse 15 should best be translated as two prayers. Now, the New American Standard that I'm using reads it as a past tense sort of thing, or sort of a standard comment, but look at the quotes in your handout. One way you could render this is, may those who hate the Lord cower in fear. That's the New American Standard has to pretend obedience, but to cower in fear, I think, is a better way to translate that Hebrew phrase. May the time of their punishment be forever. So what that's doing is calling down the curses of the covenant. The covenant made at Mount Sinai promised tremendous blessing if they would obey and trust him, and great curses if they would not. Verse 15 calls down the curses of the covenant, whereas verse 16 calls down the blessings of the covenant. In fact, verse 16, but I would feed you with the finest of the wheat. That's like, I'm going to bless you with the blessings of the promised land. This is cultivated resources, literally with the fatness of wheat. We don't think of wheat as being fat, but the idea this is healthy wheat and abundant wheat, cultivated resources as well as raw natural resources. And with honey from the rock, I would satisfy you. This is like in the cliffs where the bees are out on their own and it's just dripping with honey. Remember that Israel was said to be the promised land was a land flowing with milk, cultivated product, and honey, raw product. And so you have sort of the same kind of allusion here as well. All right, let's go to the back page and we'll walk through the psalm verse by verse. There's the visual outline chart on the back. And there's a wordy purpose statement up at the top that tries to summarize the gist of this psalm. The psalmist calls Israel to joyfully worship their ancient Redeemer during the high holy days and beyond. A divine oracle reveals that such worship includes not only a joyful expression, but also heartfelt trust and obedience to their covenant God, who is their deliverer and provider. So down in the bottom left, you see that there are four headings to the psalm. For the choir director, that's a word of authorization, that the head of the music at the tabernacle, the temple, is authorized to schedule this music and assign musicians for its performance. There's a musical note on the gittith. The gittith. Now, this could be an instrument from Gath. Gath was a Philistine city. It was a very sophisticated city. The Philistines had very high quality products. They had high quality earthenware. If you do archaeological work, you go to the Philistine cities and you dig up a pot. It's very refined. You go to Israel and dig up a pot, and they're sort of so-so. And the same thing sort of translates over to things like instruments. So you know, we have things like Spanish guitar. That's a certain style of guitar. The gittith might be a style of harp. That came from Gath, or it could be a musical style as well. It's hard to say. The word Gath means winepress, which is something you use during harvest time. So maybe there's a connection here with the fall festivals too. It's said to be a psalm of Asaph. So a psalm here refers to this is a song with instruments, and then the authorship were said it is. By Asaph, or as we've seen, sometimes that's code for any of the descendants of Asaph. All right, the psalm breaks into two parts. There's the psalmist's summons to observe festival in verses 1 through 5, the middle of verse 5. It's an invitation to worship in the high holy days. Look at that invitation to joyful worship in verses 1 to 3. It starts with calls to sing and shout to their God, who is their strength. Verse 1, sing for joy to God, our strength. Shout joyfully to the God of Jacob, the God who had brought them out of Egypt. And remember, whenever you see Israel called Jacob in the Psalms, it usually is highlighting the fact that the nation was in a weak position. Remember, Israel was the new name of Jacob. When Jacob sort of matured and grew onto a new phase of godliness and trust, he was said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, it shall be Israel. All right, and normally the nation is given that name, but sometimes his other name is used, and that usually is done to highlight the fact that the nation is needy and dependent, that they really need the Lord. He is, in fact, their strength. He's the one who had brought them out of positions of weakness and captivity. So there's singing and shouting. Remember that almost all of Israel's worship was outside. So if the music of the Psalms, if you get the hint that, man, this must have been really loud, well, yes, it was outside. So if there had been more indoor worship, we might it might not be as deafening. Verse 2, there's a call to orchestrate the songs with instruments. Raise a song, strike the timbrel. These are tambourines, which were usually played by women, interestingly. So the women out in the courtyard, and hey, they have a part to play in this. Often the playing of the timbrel, the tambourines, was accompanied by synchronized dancing. And then two more instruments are mentioned, the sweet-sounding lyre with the harp. The lyre is a smaller harp, the other harp. These are both small instruments. They're, you know, about like this. Don't think of a big orchestra harp, you know, that you're strumming like that. That's not what they had. But these different sort of stringed instruments would give different sorts of sounds, and they'd be assigned different parts. And then verse 3, there's the calls to observe the high holy days and the Feast of Tabernacles. Blow the trumpet at the new moon. So the first day of the seventh month, the Feast of Trumpets, they were required to blow trumpets that day. The word trumpet here, interestingly, is not the one you'd expect. This is the word shofar, which is the ram's horn. The Feast of Trumpets called for the blowing of the brass horns, the beaten horns. But then later on in that month, when you have Yom Kippur 10 days later, that is the one day of the year where they had to blow the shofar. So it seems like verse 3 is enwrapping all of the festivals of this month, starting with the new moon, and that the full moon, 15 days later, the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles, and then say our feast day. And I think day is understood here in the broad sense. This is the period of festivals, what's called the high holy days. So here's the invitation, joyful worship. And then verses 4 and 5 talk about why this is an obligation, why we have to do this. Why do we do this? You know, as kids grow up around the holiday season when they're really young, why do we do this, Mommy? Why do we have this holiday and that holiday and go on to this? Why do we drive ourselves crazy every year with all the things we're doing? So here's the theological explanation in verses 4 and 5. It's based upon God's covenantal law. Verse 4, for it is a statute for Israel, an ordinance for the God of Jacob, of the God of Jacob. Ordinances and statutes are synonyms, but a statute, you think about that word. What other word does that sound like? Take out one of the T's. You get a statue. A statue is usually a carved sort of thing. A statute, the Hebrew word, is like laws written in stone, that these are permanent ordinances. And the law was very specific about these sacred times that they were to be observed. These are, as in some theological systems would call these, holy days of obligation, where you had to participate. This was part of your covenant commitment to the Lord. And this is all based upon God's redemption of the nation out of Israel. Verse 5, he established it for a testimony. That's another word here for statute or ordinance. In Joseph, that is in Israel, when he, and I think that's God, when he went throughout the land of Egypt, or literally when he went out against the land of Egypt. So in that same time period that God brought the descendants of Joseph, the relatives of Joseph, out of Egypt, he made this covenant with them with these requirements. And then at the end of the verse, the third part of verse 5, is the beginning of the second half. By the way, the verse numbers, the verse breaks in our Bibles are not original either. These were added at some point. So sometimes you'll find in what we call one verse, there's actually a break in the beginning of a new section. And that's true here at the end of verse 5. So the second half of the psalm from verse 5c, we'll call it, the third part, through verse 16, this is God's summons to heed the covenant. There's already been talk about our covenant obligations with regards to festival, but our covenant responsibility is more than just keeping holidays. It's about a right relationship with God, even in the old covenant. Here's a prophetic oracle on obedience and trust. And this oracle breaks into two parts as well. Firstly, there's God's gracious response to his unresponsive people. At the end of verse 5, running through verse 7, we see God's response to Israel's call for help. God's heeded their call, the end of verse 5. I heard a language, or you could say a speech, that I did not know, that I had not heard before coming from them. The Israelites had not cried out to God in mass like they did in Exodus chapter 2. And so then the response of God in verse 6 through 7 is he's freeing them from Egyptian slavery. I relieved his shoulder of the burden. So Israelite slaves would have to bear things on their backs. His hands were freed from the basket. They would use woven baskets to carry mud and bricks and things like that. Verse 7, God speaks directly to them. You called in trouble, and I rescued you. And then he talks about how when they were in the wilderness, after bringing them out, he formed them. I answered you in the hiding place of thunder. I think this is a reference to Mount Sinai, when God came down onto the mount and thundered and shook the earth, and there was a great cloud of darkness, and he spoke to them and gave them his covenant, made covenant with them, of which the law was the central part. And then surrounding that, before and after at Mount Sinai, I proved you at the waters at Meribah. What happened there? That's where the Israelites are complaining, oh, is there, can't you provide for us? And God miraculously provides for them. And it's, you know, it's interesting, when the story is told in the Torah, Israel tests God at Meribah, which is a word that means contention. But God is actually testing them, showing what's wrong with them. That, you know, after what I did for you, you think I'm not going to provide for you? It really revealed what was wrong within their hearts. Then at the end of verse 7, there's that Hebrew word salah, left untranslated, because no one really knows what it means. But it seems to indicate a kind of pause where maybe the musician, the different instruments would play. And then in verses 8 through 10, the oracle continues with Israel's obligation to respond to God. They need to listen. Hear, O my people, and I will admonish you. O Israel, if you would listen to me. Or you could render it, Israel, oh, that you would listen to me. Now, isn't this interesting? God heard them when they cried. He heard them. But even though he spoke from the mountain and spoke through Moses, it seems like they're la, 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 la. You know, they've got their ears closed. And you can tell by the way they live. Verse 9, there's a call to undivided loyalty. Let there be no strange god among you, nor shall you worship any foreign god. Here's summarizing the first commandment, even the second commandment. They need to remember God's redemption. Verse 10 says, I am Yahweh. I, Yahweh, am your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt. And look at that call to trust his provision at the end of verse 10. Open your mouth wide and I will fill it. I mean, they were in the wilderness and God filled their mouths with manna. And then when they grumbled about that, even quail. Do they really think he can't provide for them? Do they really think they need to go look to some other god who's better suited to meet their needs? It's really just kind of folly. Oh, Israel, would you listen? Would you consider the relationship that we have? So that's the first half of the oracle. And then the second half begins in verse 11, where God's promising invitation to his unresponsive people. There's an indictment of Israel's unresponsiveness in verses 11 and 12. Israel's lack of listening is brought up again. But my people did not listen to my voice. Israel did not obey me. And the result is there was a partial abandonment of Israel in verse 12. So I gave them over to the stubbornness of their heart, to walk in their own devices. And there are times in the Old Testament stories where God withdraws his blessing. And you see the nation sputtering around and ending up in the period of the judges where they're being dominated by foreign powers with the hope that they would awaken them to that fact that they are needy, that they need the Lord. But the Lord is not done with them. This is not utter abandonment. It's partial. And so you see in verses 13 to 16, the last part of the psalm, where this invitation to Israel to respond, God's desire for their responsiveness. Oh, that my people would listen to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. This is the irony, you know, about Old Covenant versus New Covenant. In the Old Covenant, you could be part of the nation, part of the people of God, but really be unregenerate. You know, being an Israelite, being circumcised, going to festivals even, did not guarantee you a saved relationship. You had a unique national relationship. But in the New Covenant, it's different. My sheep hear my voice, Jesus says, and they follow me. In the New Covenant, you enter the New Covenant not by who your parents were or what holidays you keep, but by coming into a new relationship of new birth. So keep that in mind when you read this, that he's speaking to people who for the most part are, yes, they're the covenant people, but they are, many of them, unregenerate people. And his desire is for them to come into this renewal relationship with him. Verses 14 and 15, he promises victory over the nation's enemies. Verse 14, I would quickly subdue their enemies and turn my hand against their adversaries. those who hate the Lord may, or as I said earlier, you could render this as a prayer, may those who hate the Lord cower in fear before him. May their time of punishment be forever. There's the curses of the covenant. And you know what? Those curses are not just for the enemies of Israel. That's also for the enemies within Israel. For the fool who says in his heart, the Israelite fool who says in his heart, there is no God. There's judgment to come eventually too. Now God's desire is for all those who are within the nation to turn unto him, but there is a period, you know, where that mercy, that patience ends, and then there comes a time. And there's a talk here about the time. The New American Standard has added punishment, and I think that's right, that their time has come, the time for them to experience judgment. Verse 16 ends, though, on a positive note about the blessings of the covenant, God's promise to enrich Israel with the best of the land. But I would feed you with the finest of the wheat. That's what I want to do. That's what my goal in this whole redemptive program, bringing you out of Egypt, was to share with you the blessings of my covenantal love. So from the cultivated fields, that your wheat would be abundant here at when you come to harvest festivals like this, that you would have, you would see my hand is upon you, as well as the things you find out in the rough, and honey from the rock. Oh, what a wonderful thing to find. I've not tried this, by the way, harvesting wild honey. I don't have the right kind of gear for that, but people who live out that way know how to do it without getting stung to death. Honey from the rock, I would satisfy you. Well, as we conclude this, we have to remember we are in a different covenantal relationship with God. We're not governed by Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments in the same way that Israel was. We're in a new and living relationship with him, and there are wonderful blessings made to us in Christ, and God wants us to grow in our experience of those blessings. The more we follow Christ, obey Christ, and walk in his ways, the more we find the hand of God being upon us. Doesn't mean there'll be no adversity or trouble or difficulty, or that we won't be appointed to trials and testings. But there's this enrichment of joy. We find our hearts naturally overflowing with joy at the God who's redeemed us. And so we come then to holiday seasons like we're in, with hearts overflowing, mindful of the great things that God has done. Well, let's conclude our time in prayer. Faithful God, thank you for your mercies to us in Jesus. Thank you for calling us out of the bondage of sin and making us your own. Thank you for revealing yourself to us and your Son and enabling us to hear your voice and to walk in your ways. And may we be faithful in this covenant of love that you have initiated with us so that we might receive more of your blessings and our joy in you might be enriched and that your name might be magnified in the earth. So as we come into the hour of worship to follow, may that be true of our hearts and our mouths. In the name of Christ we pray.